Welcome to episode 282 of the Energy Talks podcast. I'm energy and climate journalist Markham Hislop. This is the electric century. And as we rush to electrify economies, the capability of the power grid becomes a limiting factor to the doubling or tripling of electricity generation and distribution. We can't have electric vehicles and electrically heated and cooled homes and electric industrial processes and clean alternative energy like hydrogen made with electricity if we can't get the power from where it's generated to where we need it. Rethink Energy has released a new report that addresses some of these issues on a global basis, and I'll be talking to Bogdan Avramudda, Director of Market Research, about them. So welcome to the interview, Bogdan.
Hi, Markham. Thanks for the invite. Happy to be here. Always pleased to talk about the global energy transition and our views.
Well, that is the basis for my journalism. So you can imagine how excited I am to have you on the podcast.
Sounds ideal.
I think taking a global perspective at it, in North America, so we're talking about United States, Mexico, and Canada. And the Americans are busy re-engineering their grid. This, you know, especially with the introduction of the Inflation Reduction Act now, there's a lot of money that is being spent on it. It really did need to be upgraded and modernized. It's, I would say, from what I've been told by other experts, that it's quite a bit behind. It wasn't, the grid wasn't as modern as Canada's. Canada doesn't have interconnected grids. It has basically 10 provinces, and each one of them has their own, for the most part. There's one exception, maybe two, but they have crown government-owned utilities that manage the grid in that province. They're like little islands, 10 little islands strung together with a few interties, and that's basically the Canadian grid. But it's 84% zero emission because it has a lot of hydro, it has a lot of nuclear, some wind and solar. And so Canada has been very complacent. I mean, it had a clean grid, it was low cost, reliable. There wasn't the same impetus to move quickly as there is in the US, but that's beginning to change. Canada's starting to wake up, and I think Mexico will be a little behind this as an emerging economy. But my thesis here is that the electric technologies we're talking about, and I mentioned some of them a minute ago, are now on the S-curve, past the inflection point for the most part, and are economic. They're competitive in the marketplace. They're starting to push out, you know, coal. They're starting to push back on gas because they are the low-cost alternative. Is that true across the globe that we're seeing wind and solar in particular be adopted because it's just the best way to go?
I mean, yeah, you touched on a couple of things there. So, I mean, we can unpack all that. But to first, you know, answer your question, first of all, I don't think that all the technologies that you mentioned are past the inflection point on the S-curve. Some of them are still early days, hydrogen being one of them. I think there's a big difference between waking up to the thought that you need to upgrade your grids and actually putting those plans into fruition and actually changing your grids and upgrading them. And so it's all good that Canada is waking up to it. The report that we recently released at Rethink Energy mostly touched on the United States and not Canada. So when we talk about North America, we mostly talked about the United States. The problem is really when you're talking about the United States is that permitting takes ages. For the report, I spoke with somebody who's been involved with one of those grid projects for the last 20 or so years. And it took them that long to get the project from paper to actually construction and the real thing. So that's really the biggest killer when we're talking about grid upgrades in North America.
So I hear that all the time, and I did an interview maybe a year or two ago about someone who had developed an app that would streamline the permitting process. I don't think it's made much of an impact. I see policymakers all the time calling for, streamlining of the permitting process. What are some of the key issues in the U.S. That are making permitting such a drawn out process?
Yeah, so some of the major issue with permitting is really the different types of permits that you need to get. So if you think about, the grid and what it in entails in terms of infrastructure, you're talking about hundreds of miles worth of pylons and copper wires and right, so infrastructure really to the largest degree. Nothing compared to, a gas power plant or a solar farm or a wind farm, right? So then when you have such large scale infrastructure spanning over a number of states, then you encounter a lot of land permit problems, right? You have, obviously, if your transmission line crosses over three states, you need approvals from all three states, right? If you're only transporting energy from state number one to state number three, but want to go through state number two, then state number two is going to say, well, what am I getting out of this? So that's extra complications. Then you run into problems with private land. People are not going to give up their land that easily. They don't really necessarily want a transmission line to go through their backyard, so to say. Then you encounter indigenous land problems, so extra permits over there. If you're also crossing through some military land, then there's military permits and so on, and things easily rack up, rack up. But that's the main problem. That's the main slowdown with permitting in the US.
That's interesting because I've been watching China with great interest, and they are adopting solar in amazingly large quantities. It's really something. And not only is it a utility scale, I think I did an interview with about 20 inter episodes back with someone about the China building these huge solar farms out in the Mongolian desert, there's
Yes.
255 of them. And th that they're so far away from the population centers, they're going to require a lot of transmission. And I guess, they run roughshod over, anybody who's, landowners or communities that might be in the way. But is there a different approach or different I issues as we see countries like China and India, Malaysia, Vietnam, as they adopt wind and solar, expand their grids, are they running into the similar kinds of problems?
Well, you basically said it in the question. If the Chinese government realizes that, we need a transmission line from A to B, that's gonna happen. And this, no one's gonna say, why is this transmission line going through my backyard, or why am I, having to, change my business or my, private land to accommodate for this, project of government importance. So things just simply, don't run as they do in the West. And the West can cry about it, but that's just the reality. This is why China's moved so fast on high voltage grid capacity from, the early 2000s until now. They've taken the lead. And that's why exactly why China is, like you mentioned, building solar for fun at the moment. 90%+ of global manufacturing capacity is in China at the moment.
Yeah, it's really something. And next week, sorry, in 2 weeks, I'll be giving a talk here in Parksville, along with Sandy Garasino from the National Observer, about China and its role in the global energy transition. And one of the points that I've made over and over again is that, China began investing in these technologies in the late 90s. And it's accelerated now, and they've scaled up the manufacturing of the equipment on the technology side, but they've done something that they're the Chinese version of what the Americans used to do, which is use their large domestic market to leverage, to provide a demand pull for the supply push that they were doing on the manufacturing side. So the two work together. And the fact that they can overcome these infrastructure hurdles is a huge advantage for them as they scale it up quickly. So I read a speech by an American politician in was given in 2022, and she said, "Look, in 2020, we here in the U.S. we woke up. We realized that in the early days of the pandemic, how vulnerable we were to Chinese supply chains." And that gets to your comment about how much, the extent to which China dominates the manufacture of these technologies. And she said, "That's why we introduced the Infrastructure Act, the CHIPS Act, the Inflation Reduction Act," which is, who knows? I mean, we'll see in 2032, but it could be a trillion or two dollars that is spent. I argue that that essentially kicked off a global clean energy arms race between China, or Asia Pacific more generally, Europe, and North America. And the grid is at the heart of that, because they're electrifying their economies, building manufacturing capacity to build that equipment. Is that a fair argument from your point of view?
Yeah, I think a lot has happened since 2020, right? So COVID-19 pandemic, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. A lot has happened in the last couple of years that really put a lot of strain on the global supply chains, which affected energy prices, which obviously affected consumers, which then affected governments. So governments had to act and had to change something. And energy independence and safety when it comes to supply chains and places we gain your energy from or energy sources. And reducing volatility was clear. I agree with that. It's a bit sad or unfortunate that it took this long and it took such big events for the West to wake up to those realities. I mentioned the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It officially started in 2022, early 2022, was it? But then Russia had attempts in 2016, right? So the story is not new. But we,
Right.
Europe decided to act in 2022 with sanctions and everything, and then avoid reliance on natural gas from Russia, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, to answer your question, yes, a lot has changed since 2020. It's a bit late to loop it back to the grid reference. A lot of this is dependent on grid upgrades, right? We have massive queues of wind and solar farms not being able to go past final investment decisions simply because they don't have a guaranteed grid connection point because the capacity is running out. So there's a lot of strain on the grid to upgrade, which is why there's I mentioned to you in the small talk that we had before we started pressing record. This global energy transition is one big puzzle, and you really need to be pragmatic and have a very thorough, holistic view of the whole thing in order for this to work. We need to start, governments need to start thinking, okay, the goal here is literally the survival of our race, right? We're talking about climate change and raising temperature and uninhabitable sections of the world. You need to think that's the goal, and to possibly stop thinking about money that much, but obviously, unfortunately, we live in a world dictated by money.
Well, the reason I brought up where the clean energy technologies are on the S curve, and I would agree with you. Hydrogen is not anywhere close to its inflection point at this point. So I'm at the more the electric technologies as opposed to the clean fuels, sustainable fuels that are made with clean electricity. And the point on that is that from my where I sit, climate policy now is not so much about are we going to adopt wind, solar, batteries, EVs, and so on. It's how fast are we going to do it. And that's the policy now dictates pace, not economics. the economics are basically self-sustaining. They're competitive, and for the most part, we can always think of exceptions. So having said that, where we've talked about China, so China doesn't have the permitting problems that we see in North America, because Canada has this, essentially the same problems as the US. A lot of NIMBYism, people worried about their own backyards. What about Europe? Does Europe, can Europe expand, electrify with the existing grid, or is it going to have to build a lot of infrastructure?
No, Europe is basically in the same spot as the US in terms of, lagging behind necessary capacity. The queues that I mentioned for wind and solar even in China, they exist even in China. Those are present in Europe as well as North America. So Europe very much needs to employ the same type of strategies as the US when it comes to, grid upgrades. What the US, sorry, what Europe is doing is putting a lot of reliance on interconnections and, like I said, taking more of a holistic approach of the whole continent, taking, the different countries and trying to come up with efficient plans of, transporting electrons from A to B, from point of generation to point of usage. But yes, to link it back to what you said in a couple of moments ago about China supplying, pushing supply and pushing demand at the same point. And touch on policy. I agree with you. There's plenty of policies being said. The necessary policies are set in place in the West. It's just a question of clarifying them, right? In order for companies and businesses to take advantage of those policies and the incentives that the policy is promoting, you need a legal framework that's clear and that's set in place, right? So there's one thing for the US to come up with the IRA and the EU to come up with the Green Deal and say this is the policies that we came up with, this is the incentives that we're bringing up. But there's a totally different ball game for companies to actually benefit from those and apply those and make the changes to their businesses according to those policies in order to take the incentives.
Yeah, I mentioned Alberta earlier. They're going through some, in the last 2 weeks, they've introduced a policy to restrict renewables. Last Wednesday, they came out with a policy to enable industrial players to self-generate, store with batteries, and then sell into the grid. On Monday, they came out with a document that will guide the restructuring of their electricity markets. And I've spent the last week or so interviewing a fair number of experts about that. And at the subnational level, that Alberta seems to illustrate your point, because it's clear, I think, that there is no consensus, there is no vision, there is the leadership is lacking. And so not everybody's clear on where we're going, why we're going there, how we're going to get there, what my role is, what your role is, what so-and-so's role is. And it's a bunch of people in a dark room bumping heads. And you can see now the impediment to progress that kind of uncertainty, policy uncertainty, political uncertainty leads to investment uncertainty, and how it impedes progress. And so it's almost like a little case study of how not to do things. And I would imagine that there are countries in the EU and states in the US where it's being done really well, where you have this vision, everybody's pulling in the same direction. And then you have jurisdictions where it's being done poorly. Is that fair to say?
Yes, very much. I mean, I was actually reading about something about the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, and about some of the perhaps less the section and the incentives that were perhaps less under the spotlight, right? Everybody was talking about, green hydrogen subsidies and the billions spent on fuels and reshoring manufacturing and supply chains. But then I was reading a section on there was quite a bit of money put forward for increasing building efficiencies, right? Building efficiency in terms of temperature and heating and heat pumps and things like that. And actually, states of Florida, Kentucky, South Dakota, and there was one more, refused to gain any money from it because they didn't want to, probably, the congressmen and the senators, in charge of the states, probably didn't want their feathers to be rattled too much by changing the way they build the buildings because I don't know, they probably had some real estate links or something like that. So yes, very much a case of some countries are doing and or some states are doing better than others when it comes to getting us all the way to net zero.
It's you know what? I don't I always look for the simplest answer. And I don't think it's economic or financial self-interest on the part of the policymakers and other, movers and shakers in those particular states, so much as it is ideology. I mean, there are still a very large percentage of the population in the West, and it varies by country and by state, I suppose. But who really don't believe in climate change. They think it's, I know people in Alberta who are convinced that it's just a manufactured crisis to, basically a business model of Greenpeace, that kind of approach. So they don't want anything to do with policy or more than they have to, and they don't see it. They don't see the energy transition in economic terms. See, like in Alberta, and I keep you coming back to Alberta because that's where I do a lot of my journalism. But the point here is that they see it as an ideological and political conflict, one that can be fixed by electing the right politicians, as opposed to the rise of a new form of energy, which is a competition, a competitor to fossil fuels. And when you see it as a competitor that is disrupting your business model and you have to respond, whether you're a company or you're a jurisdiction, then you treat the transition very differently. You understand that you are essentially in the position of being Kodak or Blockbuster. If you don't respond to disruption, you will eventually be pushed out of the market. You'll fail, and with all of the consequences that come with that. And I we follow enough American politics up here in Canada that those particular states that you mentioned, the Ron DeSantis in Florida, and South Dakota's got a couple of wacky senators that are just really out on the fringe, but they're thought leaders. They're thought leaders. This is the problem. The thought leaders are wacky. They haven't done their work. They see this all in, some grand, culture war that's going on. But that then becomes a real impediment to change. And is that a fair observation?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I think there's plenty of politicians who really make rash decisions, and the UK is another great example of this. Our prime minister is really turning, whichever way the wind is blowing, and by the wind I mean, the lobbyists, and by blowing I mean, whatever whispers they whisper in his ear. So one week he's pushing nuclear, another week he's pushing the natural gas for our power plants. Unfortunately, neither will see the UK reach net zero by 2050. So it's very much a case of a lot of countries, a lot of economies being the victims in some cases of leaders making rash decisions. The US obviously is under the microscope at the moment due to the election that's going to happen later this year and all the potential uncertainty that's already gathering. The feeling that I'm hearing from the industry and from the people that you don't need to sign off on the big money checks. So, investors, banks, etc. When they're looking at the US today and the potential involvement in the US for the next couple of years, the potential presidency of Donald Trump is, not to get too political, is gathering quite a bit of uncertainty. So people are wary of that.
Yeah, I think that it's fair to say, without being overly partisan, that changes in policy can lead to changes in investment patterns
I agree with that.
and perceptions of uncertainty and where people put their money. Bogdan, before I let you go, I want to address an issue that arises over and over again when I talk to experts about power grids, and that is the extent to which new technologies are disrupting them and, well, I mean, making them better. I had Gerhard Schlage, who's the chief technology officer from Hitachi Energy, on about 17 or 18 episodes ago. And he was talking about storage, power electronics, and digital controls as being three key technologies that utilities and system operators are integrating into their grid, so that they can adopt a higher percentage of intermittent power generation into those grids. And then on top of that, there's all kinds of other technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning and materials, and goodness gracious. I mean, it's a very disruptive period in what is usually a very staid and conservative industry, you know. The power sector just doesn't change that quickly. And I'm wondering the extent to which those technologies and that disruption are affecting grids outside of North America, in Europe, in China, in Asia Pacific, emerging economies. We mentioned Brazil. Like, are they taking, do they see that as a problem, or are they going, hey, this is terrific. We can use these technologies to now get, carry more power in our grid. We can do more things with it without spending a lot of money, and they see it as a way to leverage the transition for economic gain. What's the take on that at a global level, if you can?
Yeah, I think Europe is really leading the way in terms of, you mentioned AI and grid digitization is one big thing that's going to improve the grid efficiency significantly from now on until 2050 and hopefully beyond. And when you really think about it, this is something that that we mentioned in the report that Rethink Energy published. It's really talking about virtual power plants and grid digitization. That essentially means when you have, a couple of solar panels over here, a couple of wind turbines over there, a couple of energy storage systems in between, and your usual nuclear and gas and whatnot. If you can have a digital tool that's aware of the generation potential and the demand curve on a daily basis, on a hour by hour basis, or even minute by minute basis, you can effectively move electrons from A to B, using storage as well, in order to not oversaturate the grid, in order to supply all the demand effectively and efficiently. So that really is the future, and I see that as having huge potential, and Europe is leading the way at the moment when it comes to that.
Again, I want to get back to Alberta because they passed some legislation. It's called Bill 22, to enable exactly the thing you're talking about. So, because Alberta, with a small population of 5 million people, but it has more industry in Canada than any other province, petrochemical plants and refineries, and the oil sands are a huge, one of the world's largest industrial, industrial sites. But here's what hit the point I'm getting at. In the way the government sees this is if big industrial players can self-generate using wind and turbine, but maybe even gas, store the electricity on site using batteries or compressed air or whatever technology they decide to do that, They then remove some load off the grid so that as demand expands, there's less demand for more transmission infrastructure. They see it as a way to reduce the pressure that's on the existing grid. And I think that's a great idea. I think that's part of something we've talked about here with experts quite a number of times. The problem is, even though it's a good idea, it's not integrated into this larger vision for the economy and for the power grid itself. It's like it's off this, they listened to the lobbyists for a couple of years and went, well, that's a good idea. Let's draw up a bill and enable that thing. Now, how that's going to work with the rest of the grid, or how that's going to work with, how that's going to affect prices for the ones that remain on the grid, none of that got thought through. And it's like another little case study of good intentions, trying to do the right thing, a good thing, but getting it wrong. And then that raises the question of what happens down the road, 5 years from now, when the consequences of getting it wrong become apparent, and it's causing problems. And you said earlier in this interview, it's like putting a puzzle together. And some jurisdictions will be good puzzle players, and some will be not so good puzzle players. And so kind of you introduce the human element back into the transition, and that will, to some extent anyway, determine the winners and losers.
Yes, which is why I guess being from Europe makes me feel a bit better, because I feel like there's been more cohesion in Europe, even though we're talking about different countries, right? Compared to the states, where you have the same country but different states, that's a bit counterintuitive. But yes, I think that because you mentioned lobbyists, I think politicians, lobbyists, and people need to move away from the old ways of, oh, okay, we have extra demand, let's just build another power plant and, keep ranking up the power output, put it on the grid, move it from A to B to the industrial side, get the, economic output up. The world is changing. It's when talking about energy storage and assets and grid that needs to be managed and effectively upgraded, and everything takes and requires a lot of money, and you have all those different fuels and these different outlets and so on and so forth. It's just things are more complex, so we need to live up to those challenges.
Another case study from Alberta. I have some of our energy media readers are in a little town in southwest Alberta. It's very windy. It was the site of the first wind turbines in Alberta back in the late 1990s, called Pincher Creek. It's a town of about 3,000 people. And these folks are fairly forward thinking, and they understand the transition, and they the key point here is they understand that wind resource can be further harnessed, and it can produce abundant, low cost, clean electricity. That's a huge competitive advantage. Now, they have other competitive disadvantages, the size of their community and their distance away from large metropolitan markets. Fair enough. But they've been talking to me about, well, Markham, what could we do in Pincher Creek that would, if we put up some more wind turbines, could we build a clean energy industrial park, where companies could get really cheap renewable energy, and they would locate their plants here, and then they would create jobs and economic activity in our community, that kind of thing. And here's the point I want to get to. For them, it's not so much about the grid supplying electricity to all of the province. It's about, how do I take that electricity that's generated locally by renewable assets and do something locally with a microgrid, with an industrial park that has a microgrid? How do I leverage these technologies to make our community more competitive in this global, in the global economy? And I'm just wondering the extent to which that kind of conversation takes place in the US, it takes place in Europe, takes place in Asia. Is that a big part, a little part, growing part of this conversation?
Well, I'm gonna take the concept that you just brought up, but I'm gonna move it from the community level to the economy level, right? The country level. Because if you have a location on the globe with favorable wind or solar conditions, which will obviously increase the amount of electricity you produce, so it will effectively decrease the cost per unit of electricity you then sell. You want to leverage that. So this is where the concept of decentralization comes in, right? This is why Europe is pumping a lot of money into Africa and building wind and solar farms and hydrogen plants and green ammonia plants, which comes from hydrogen, into Africa because they can get it cheaper. So to your point, yes, small communities who are blessed with such resources, natural resources, should do everything they can to sort of attract and bring in their communities industrial sites or any sort of output that they can generate to help the global energy transition.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. And it's, I mean, let's briefly talk about distributed energy resources, because this is something that is front and center in the American conversation. Because the Department of Energy, the Loan Program, has got Jigar Shah, out evangelizing for virtual power plants. They want to put a lot of money into them. And they want to, and that's his job, is to sell people on putting these in so that they can amalgamate all of the residential storage, presumably later down the road, electric vehicles when we get EV to grid integration figured out, all of that. They want to maximize the value and the utility of those assets, those storage assets. So that's just one example. And we're seeing opportunities come, like the LA Hydrogen LA, where there's a bunch of actors coming in around Los Angeles, including the city, and they want to use the LA's cheap solar to make hydrogen, store it, and then when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, then they would feed it into their old gas power plants that have been fitted out with turbines that can, run on dual fuel, that kind of thing. I mean, there just seems to th this technology seems to be really suited, this DER technology, to decent not just decentralize energy production, but decentralize economic production and economic opportunities. And I'm wondering the extent to which that idea permeates the conversations that you're having it with people in different countries.
No, it's very much the case. It's very much the case. When you need to switch from, traditionally burning coal, burning natural gas, you're talking about energy per per weight, per kilogram or per liter, per things, energy density. And now when you're talking about wind and solar, you're talking about really energy per square meter, right? You're talking about buying the land first, which is hectares. And then building solar farms. So when size becomes a constraint, and you wanna make that very efficient, and if you can put it on, because this is basically how it all started. If you can put the solar panels on people's roofs, close to the source of demand, then that makes sense. Which is why virtual power plants and grid digitization and things that I mentioned before, all make sense. But yes, the entire globe is aware of that and is banking card on distributed assets.
We talked a lot about Canada, about the US, and some about Europe. You brought up some examples, but we'll close out the interview with this discussion, Bogdan. Last fall, there was a lot of talk about the OPEC slow energy transition narrative, and it came out the modeling that supported that narrative came out in October, I think it was. And in the world, the world oil outlook 2045 is the title of the report. And one of the key assumptions in that report is that emerging economies like Africa will not electrify, that they will stick with fossil fuels because they have abundant resources, they have a lot of the infrastructure already built, and so the OECD countries will electrify, and the non-OECD countries like the ones in Africa will stick with fossil fuels. But if I'm sitting there in Africa and I've got this amazing, solar resource, and now that we're getting to the point where the marginal cost of, electricity will be zero, we're getting close to that. We can kind of see it in the not too distant future. I'm looking at that and going, man, that's an economic opportunity. And I don't need to have a huge centralized power grid to take advantage of that opportunity. And I'm wondering the extent to which the emerging economies think like that.
Yes, I mean, some degree of political corruption and associated hurdles aside, when it comes to the African continent, and energy being always linked with politics, I agree with you. It does make sense, and like I mentioned, Europe is investing heavily in Africa, and a lot of those partnerships and those deals are not stopping with, we want to use your land to build a solar farm and then just try, convert that into hydrogen and then put it on a ship, send it back to Europe, and we don't care about anything else. A lot of those partnerships do extend to take into account the socioeconomic factors of the community as well. So if they can build a bit of extra infrastructure, which is, nothing compared to the cost of, the big industrial park that they're trying to build in Africa, and thus help the community and help countries and economies and developing economies, like you mentioned, in Africa, electrify and create additional sources of demand for clean energy, then that benefits everybody.
Gotcha. Well, Bogdan, thank you very much for this. This has been a very interesting conversation, and I think that we don't put enough emphasis, or we don't pay enough attention to the ways in which these new technologies and are going to be disruptive and change the economy in which we work and make our living, and the way the internal combustion engine and petroleum did 100 years ago. I think we're kind of headed in that direction. We're having trouble seeing how, this might lead to the rise of Africa as an economic power, or the rise of India or Bangladesh, something like that. But that's kind of the direction we're going. And looking at this through the global lens is a fascinating exercise. We've done some of that today, and I really appreciate your insights. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you for having me, Marham. Always good to talk to fellow people about these topics.